From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, the different meanings of space. From the cosmos.
It's exciting. It's fun. It's being understanding the universe, being connected to the universe and being connected with other people and making the world a better place.
To the spaces between us.
We're here. We're neighbors. We acknowledge them. Question is, are we going to be acknowledged in terms of the spaces we inhabit, the spaces we call home?
To the question of what is a reasonable space when it comes to our border and how it's guarded. All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we look at the possibilities of space. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Do you realize that you should go? I'm in misery.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're spacing out. We're talking about space. Oh my God, all of a sudden I'm feeling so spacey. Okay. Joining me today is Latino USA senior producer AC Valdez.
Hi, Maria.
Hey. All right, AC, so what do you mean when you say space?
Well, there's a really good way to visualize this, Maria. I want you to take this nice thick marker and the whiteboard you got.
Got it.
And I want you to draw me a map of the United States, the lower 48. And as you're doing that, tell me what kind of cities you're hitting along the way while you're drawing that outline.
I got to Seattle. I passed by Chicago over here, Miami, El Paso, Texas, and San Diego.
Now, I want you to pretend that that line, that's 100 miles wide.
So the entire outline of the United States of America, and then 100 miles in from that entire outline.
And that is where Customs and Border Protection has authority.
Okay, so I have to wrap my head around this because usually, you know, when you think about the border and you think about the Border Patrol, you think about them actively guarding the southern border. But if it's about the borders around all of the outlines of the United States, the entire country, that means that they're everywhere.
And that's what you call reasonable distance.
Reasonable distance?
Reasonable distance is this thing where the Border Patrol says that within 100 miles of any land or any maritime border, they have jurisdiction. And I talked to some people who really think a lot about this, and one of them is James Lyle at the ACLU of Arizona.
In 1946, the Immigration and Nationality Act, the INA, was amended to give Border Patrol broad authority within a, quote, reasonable distance of the border. It was defined by the Department of Justice in federal regulations in 1953. And at that time, the Department of Justice said that reasonable distance would be 100 miles from any external boundary.
In the meantime, the Border Patrol has grown to become the largest law enforcement agency in the country. That means a lot more Americans, not just at the border, are interacting with Border Patrol agents.
I was coming home from work, and they stopped me, and they asked me if I was a U.S. citizen, and how long I owned my car, and if they could search my trunk.
Julia Turner lives in southern Arizona. She goes through these checkpoints every day.
And they told me their dog had hit on something in the trunk.
Julia had nothing in her trunk. Never has.
It's kind of ridiculous that they want to search my car every single time. And so I just get annoyed with them, and I guess they can tell.
Julia's dad, Brian, is a former sheriff's deputy. He feels like there's a lack of professionalism and respect with the way Border Patrol works at checkpoints in general. A little bit of background. Julia looks Latina, though her father is Caucasian. She's adopted.
And I even went to the point of driving Julia's car down to the checkpoint. And after they waved me through, I stopped and I rolled the windows back down. And I said, I'm so-and-so, and it's my daughter in this vehicle that you keep stopping and harassing. And she is of Hispanic origin. How would you feel if it was your daughter, gentlemen? And I don't know how it was taken. Three or four maybe looked at me. They ignore me. They ignore a lot of the Caucasians and just wave them through. Without using the word profile, I don't know what else to do.
Racial profiling comes up time and again as a problem in the complaints the ACLU has submitted to Border Patrol. Julia actually is one of the complainants.
I'm being honest. I don't see it.
Art Del Cueto has been with the Border Patrol for 11 years.
I work out of the Tucson sector, and I am the president of the local 2544, which is the union council that covers the entire Tucson sector.
Customs and Border Protection issued me a statement which reads, in part, CBP does not tolerate racial profiling or agent misconduct and appropriately investigates allegations of wrongdoing. After they declined an interview, I realized that talking with Art was probably a way to get some frank and honest answers talking to a real person. Border Patrol's union presidents are a bit more free to go outside the official channels, and he was pretty upfront with me.
Obviously, if we see a rancher in his boots and, you know, he's wearing his cowboy hat and an older pickup truck and he's a white guy, you don't see anything, you're not going to pull him over. Now, I see somebody who looks more Hispanic that's darker. He's got several backpacks. He's got a newer truck. He's out in the middle of nowhere. You know, he's got water, food. You know, we know what they're doing. They're out there supplying the bandits. They're out there supplying the scouts.
Scouts for the drug trade. Art told me that 60% of the drugs that come into the country come in through Arizona. It means constantly being on high alert. Even if the original purpose of a checkpoint stop is to inquire about resident status. And a lot of Border Patrol agents, like Art, are Latinos themselves.
Ever since I was a kid, I grew up in a border town. But there was only two ways to go coming out of that town. And it was either the right way or the wrong way. When you're a child, you play cops and robbers. I always wanted to be the cop.
For people at an economic disadvantage, law enforcement means a productive job. A way out. But that means accepting that sometimes law enforcement's just not popular.
I actually sat down with all these, you know, what I'd call anti-border patrol groups.
Activist groups like No More Deaths, National Council of La Raza.
And they had tons of questions, and I answered all their questions, and they were very grateful at the end. You know, hey, you took the time to ask them. You may not like some of the answers, but at least you're getting an answer.
But your average person, someone like Julia, isn't an activist. I asked her what might make her feel better about the way she's been treated at checkpoints.
Most of the nights, some of the guys, they don't even talk to me. They just ask me if I'm a U.S. citizen, and then they just tell me to go through. Sometimes I have this one who will ask me how my day is or tell me to have a good evening.
Art Del Cueto told me, if there's outreach at all, it's slow in coming.
The problem is it needs to go very slowly, and I think they're pushing in that direction. A lot of those bridges have been burned a long time ago, and there is that public mistrust.
All of the people you've heard from live in Arizona, but considering the size of the Border Patrol and its enormous jurisdiction, there's reason to believe people far from the Mexico border should think about the role it plays in their community, even outside the 100-mile zone. James Lyle from the Arizona ACLU.
So some of the abuses that we hear reported are even further into the interior than the regulations would dictate. One notorious example, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont was stopped at a checkpoint 125 miles from the New York-Canada border. The New York Civil Liberties Union documented through a Freedom of Information Act request hundreds of stops of individuals on mass transit in upstate New York. And it showed widespread racial profiling, widespread stops far from the border, very few of them resulting in the initiation of removal proceedings, many resulting in the unlawful detention of people who were lawfully present.
You can see a map on our website, latinousa.org. of the 100-mile zone in which the Border Patrol operates. Around two-thirds of our country's population lives there. For Latino USA, I'm AC Valdez.
AC Valdez is Latino USA's senior producer. And now to the spaces occupied by those detained by the Border Patrol. Last year, the Dream Nine, a group of young, undocumented immigrants, self-deported to Mexico and then re-entered the United States asking for asylum. They were taken to the Eloy Detention Center in Arizona, and soon this sparked a national campaign, #BringThemHome. Lulu Martinez, a queer Chicana and college student, is one of the Dream Nine. I sat down with Lulu in Chicago on the campus of the University of Illinois to talk about her fight for citizenship and her activism, which she believes prepared her for what she saw in Arizona.
We had talked to people in detention centers, so we were very familiar with sort of how our experience might be. And we're like, no, we're going to interpret for these women, right? Or at least like give them the right documentation so that they can talk to their deportation officer, like basic things like that.
Lulu says the women detainees at Eloy were afraid to talk to her and her fellow activists. They said the officers had warned other detainees that if they did, they could be punished for it.
We recognize that the women at that point, like, were not really talking to us anymore. We're like, no, we have to do something, right? And so we went to the cafeteria, which is when most of us start to congregate. And we get up on a table and we start chanting. The chants that we use at our rallies here, undocumented, unafraid. And the women start chanting with us.
But after all of the chanting, she and fellow activist Maria Peniche were put into solitary confinement for handing out legal helplines to other detainees.
How long were you in solitary?
About a week. So we were there a total of 2 weeks, and I spent a week in solitary.
The Dream Nine were released in August last year while their asylum hearings continue. After her experience in detention, I asked Lulu what she would say if she could speak to President Obama.
I think it wouldn't necessarily be to ask for any particular type of action. I think it would just be like, you know, sharing our stories. Like I would ideally be there with a group of my friends and we'd be like, this is our conversation with you as people and as people who like have a very complex history. And if you can't understand that on a human level, then there's no other way to talk to you, right?
As she spoke, Lulu's very determined face suddenly became soft, and her eyes welled up.
Just tell me, what's the feeling?
I think it's frustration, definitely. There's a lot of folks who continue to work with politicians and with, like, nonprofits, and it's really basic. Like, it's really basic to be able to be with our families.
In truth, I was surprised to find out that Lulu's desire for citizenship comes from a deep feeling, not so much about this country, but for her mother and father.
Citizenship within itself is very limited, right? It doesn't mean that I'm going to have access to an education. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be employed or that I'm going to have like a house someday. But I think that it's also a symbolic way of letting my parents know, like, right? Like it wasn't in vain. So I think it comes back to like my family values.
That's really profound.
Yeah.
And it's also that deep sense of familia that gives Lulu the strength to be an American activist.
That's why we're able to risk like deportation. That's why we're able to do like civil disobedience, right? Because we have each other and we have a network.
Lulu Martinez is a member of the Fearless Undocumented Alliance, or FUA, in Chicago. If you want to watch our full interview, go to latinousa.org. Coming up on Latino USA, a Puerto Rican jungle inside a Massachusetts school.
And they said, when I go there, when I have a problem with the teacher, I escape to that room, and it makes me feel better. You know, even adults here, they come and breathe.
Making space for calm on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan.
Insensata y verdadera, imprudente y convincente, fluye contra la corriente. No hago caso al comentario de la gente que no tiene antena para lo que siente. Te amo de una forma que destruye toda norma, sentimiento que se sale de romances medievales. Por la espalda un empujón de mi paciencia.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're talking about space. And you might think about space in the sky, but what about on the ice? These days, ice fishermen in the Great Lakes region are treading on thinner ice than usual. Climate change is forcing them to start casting their rods about 2 weeks later than they used to, and to pack up about a month earlier.
So we've lost about 25% of the ice fishing season over the last 150 years.
That's John Magnuson, a professor at the University of Wisconsin, and he's an expert on, ice. And he says, ice cover is thinning all across the country. The space and the time is shrinking. Reporter Leslie McClurg joins an ice fisherman now in the Rockies who's traveling to higher ground in search of thicker ice.
Jesse Ogas drags a giant sled filled with fishing gear across 11 Mile Reservoir in central Colorado. His 11-year-old nephew, Miguel Alona, assists. A frosty wind sweeps across this snow-covered lake. The sun is shining, but the air is numbing, hovering around 10 degrees. Jesse and Miguel pause to catch their breath about 400 feet from the shoreline. They're 8,600 feet high.
I'm exhausted.
What all is in there?
You've got your ice auger, ice hut. We've got chairs. We have a huge tackle box, as you can see, because that houses lures and power bait and mealworms and you name it.
Every weekend, Jesse drives 2 hours southeast of Denver to come here. He used to fish closer to his house, but he says the lakes at lower elevations just don't freeze as thick as they used to.
You hear those incidents where fishermen went through the ice and, you know, you had the rescue out there to pull them out. So I don't fish the lakes below 6,000 feet anymore.
Jesse fires up his green metal ice auger to slice a hole through the frozen water. He drills through about 3 feet of ice. He rigs 10 different fishing poles with brightly colored lures. He drops the line in through a 12-inch circle and jigs the rod up and down. Miguel leans in for a closer look.
And what that jig looks like is it looks like a wounded fish. And so a fish coming by might think that's free dinner. You want to try that?
Not really. Too frigid for me. But I can see why people like Jesse are lured to enjoy the silence in the vast open space.
It's my time to relax, get away from the everyday, you know, hustle and bustle that we face.
Ice fishing goes back several generations in Jesse's Latino family. Jesse learned from his father in New Mexico, where he grew up. Jesse's father learned from his grandfather. And then when Jesse moved to Colorado 30 years ago, he carried on the tradition by teaching his sons and now his grandkids. Today, by noon, Jesse and Miguel have caught 13 rainbow trout. But they won't be eating seafood tonight.
They're averaging 8 to 10 inches, and we don't keep those. We let those go.
He says this year has been the slowest ice fishing season in more than a decade. John Magnuson, the Wisconsin ice expert, is walking across Lake Mendota in Madison. He says unpredictable seasons will become the norm as climate change shakes things up.
The lake is completely covered with snow and out in the middle with very thin ice.
In the 1850s and 60s, Lake Mendota used to freeze an average of 4 months a year. Now it's 3 months, and sometimes it's as short as 3 weeks. Magnuson says the ice fishing season is shrinking all over the world.
The change in the ice dates is occurring in alpine lakes in Switzerland. It's occurring in far northern lakes in Finland and Canada.
He says cross-country skiers, hockey players, and ice boaters need to be more careful. He predicts that accidents will become more common.
There's already been a death of a snowmobiler on a river near here. Even a well-experienced fishing guide on Lake Superior went through the ice in the inshore areas of Lake Superior last summer and drowned.
And it's not just people who are affected. Ice is also important to what's below the surface. It's part of the ecological cycle. The fish slow down when it's cold, a kind of hibernation. A shorter winter curtails their rest, and hotter temperatures in the summer can also stress them out.
Okay, you ready, Miguel? One, two, three, go.
One more.
Jesse Ogas hasn't noticed any changes in the catch at 11 Mile Reservoir, at least not yet. So he'll keep making the two-hour trip here in hopes that bigger fish will bite next weekend. For Latino USA, I'm Leslie McClurg at 11 Mile Reservoir, Colorado.
In Holyoke, Massachusetts, there's a space in a middle school that doubles as a rainforest, the kind that you would find in Puerto Rico. Puerto Ricans have been coming to Holyoke for decades, but for the youngest Boricuas, this classroom is the closest they might get to their ancestral home. Karen Brown reports.
Outside the windows of Peck Middle School, you can still see a few muddy piles of snow left over from this year's endless New England winter. But inside one second floor classroom, it's warm, moist, and green.
Okay, come on, kids. You can go inside.
Amid leafy green rows of tropical plants, you hear the sounds of falling water, the songs of wind chimes, and the chirping of a coqui, a tiny tree frog native to Puerto Rico. Okay, the coqui is on CD, but the plants are real, more than 300 of them, from avocado and cilantro to coffee and sweet potatoes to green bananas and a brilliant red flame tree.
This is the flamboyant, but so most of the picture you see from Puerto Rico got the flamboyant on it. So this is the sea, the little seas right here. This is the flamboyant.
School outreach worker Gerardo Munoz, a Puerto Rican transplant himself, created this mini rainforest from seeds he'd been cultivating at home for years.
Some people bring me to me, the secretary bring me some different seeds. You got a lot of family, they send me.
Last fall, Munoz began to bring his plants into the classroom. He added a heater and a couple fountains. He calls this space El Yunque, after Puerto Rico's national rainforest.
We see the pineapple here. And then a mango, lemon here. This is que son lo que es mapping.
Holyoke's roots are Irish, and to pay respect, Munoz tucked a few leprechauns among the guava. But today, Puerto Ricans make up half the population. Munoz says he wanted to give new arrivals a way to hold on to their culture and climate. And he wanted those with more distant connections to learn about their origins. And there's one more thing. Munoz, who's 48, is struggling with serious health issues. He hopes to leave a legacy to the kids, including his own teenage son, who came to the mainland at age 4.
He never go back to Puerto Rico. So I have to teach him this is the orange, this is that. Because, and the same thing I do with my kid, I want to do with the other student.
But there's more to El Yunque than an enhanced botany lesson.
This is a school that has too many kids with behavior problems. They come into here, you know, to calm down, to de-escalate the kid.
It's beautiful here.
Bralian is a 13-year-old who recently arrived from Puerto Rico. Sometimes she gets into fights with other girls in her class. When that happens, she's sent to El Yunque, and she says it settles her. Her teacher, Digna Hernandez, helps translate.
Because he looks like Puerto Rico, and also, you know, she can think about that, you know, when she was there, and also it's peaceful and kind.
Some kids end up here on their own. School counselor Ida Ortiz says it's not uncommon for students to get agitated and disappear from their regular classroom, only to be found in the rainforest.
And they said, when I go there, when I have a problem with the teacher, I escape to that room, and it makes me feel better. But, you know, even adults here, they come and breathe, counting me.
Including you?
Including me.
Counselors use the classroom for therapy, and even Massachusetts Social Service Agency has gotten wind of its soothing properties. Social workers who come to investigate potential child abuse interview kids in El Yunque. Munoz says that's because the kids often feel too scared to talk in a regular office.
When they come into here, they start looking all everything, you know, everything around, look at the electric butterfly over there, and then this, you know, the social worker got more opportunity to ask him something because they don't feel afraid of anything.
Some social workers have even given Munoz personal donations for the garden. With that money, he bought a statue of an angel.
This is an angel for the kid.
In his own way, Munoz is another angel for the kids. He buys most of the gardening supplies himself and tends to the plants on his own time. That's not just for the students' sake, but for his own. He tells me why as I'm leaving.
I got a terminal problem. I will be maybe there in 2 years or 3 years. Who knows? I got cancer. But he said, okay.
Wait, you have cancer?
Yeah, I got cancer.
There are times, Munoz says, when he starts the day in chemotherapy and ends it under the lush green canopy of El Yunque. If one day he's no longer around to teach the kids about their native island, he's hoping the living, growing plants will do it for him. For Latino USA, I'm Karen Brown in Holyoke, Massachusetts.
Okay, everyone, and now get excited, because we're about to talk about zoning. Thrilling, right? I don't know. You probably think it's just lines and spaces on a map, right? But how that map gets filled in determines who has the right to claim a space as their own. In San Diego, a zoning battle is pitting residents of a poor Latino neighborhood against the powerful maritime industry. Sandia Dirks takes us there.
Barrio Logan is a small slip of land that hugs San Diego's working waterfront, and at its heart is a green space called Chicano Park that's shoved in beneath the freeway. Underneath the concrete and steel are beautiful multicolored murals that speak of the Chicano struggle.
I mean, if we look around, we see historical figures such as Frida Kahlo, Emiliano Zapata.
That's San Diego State University professor Roberto Hernandez. He says this park wasn't supposed to be a park. It was supposed to be a California Highway Patrol station, but when residents fought for it in the 70s, it became something else.
We often speak of it as el ombligo, or a belly button, right? A link, an umbilical cord that links us to the places we inhabit, that establishes that we are in fact part of this land and that we can't just be removed at the will of industry.
If the park wasn't meant to be a park, Barrio Logan wasn't meant to be a barrio, a neighborhood. But it is now. About 20,000 people live here in a hodgepodge of homes next to industrial warehouses. The sound of heavy machinery mixes with the clattering of cars and trucks. And the ocean breeze carries the acrid smell of machine shops, which helps to explain the messages inscribed on the park's murals.
Why us? Save the park. Environmental racism.
State data shows that Barrio Logan has one of the highest rates of asthma-related hospital visits in all of California. And people I talked to reported a high incidence of cancer, even miscarriages in their families.
They have another one, like 1, 2, like 3 blocks from here.
Yeah.
Not far from Chicano Park, Maria Moya is talking with residents of the Mercado housing projects. She says people ended up living here because the shipyards needed them during both World Wars.
They brought, you know, Mexican families to this community to work in the industries because everybody was at war and they needed the labor. So they allowed people to come, but there were restrictions on where people of color could live. So what did they do? They placed them in Barrio Logan because they were close to the industries. They didn't have to go out into their white areas.
Moya says the immigrants of Barrio Logan made their own schools, built their own markets. They made it home. But they never got the kind of zoning residential neighborhoods usually get. Zoning that would, let's say, prevent a factory from popping up right next to a kindergarten.
And this is hurting our health. The only solution would be for those industries to be placed in away from the communities where they are not harming our daily lives.
That's why when the San Diego City Council passed new zoning for Barrio Logan last fall, residents were overjoyed. The zoning measure is pretty modest. It simply creates a buffer zone between residents and industry. Industry already there can stay, but any new ones will be regulated. Still, for the maritime industry, that's too much ground to give.
Ripped out the welcome mat from underneath us. The message is, we don't want industry in the barrio. Okay? That's not a good message to be sending.
Derry Pence heads San Diego's Ship Repair Association.
You can't just make a decision based solely on what's in the best interest of this group. You have to think about the greater good.
According to campaign finance records, the Ship Repair Association has spent $730,000 on a citywide referendum effort to overturn Barrio Logan's new zoning. Paid workers claim the plan would cause the Navy to leave and that it would cost 46,000 jobs.
This is to help save jobs at the shipyards, part two.
And why are they trying to take away the shipyards?
What they're wanting
in hotels?
No, they want to build condos.
Back in Barrio Logan, Roberto Hernandez wonders if residents can't win this small compromise, how can they ever win anything?
We're here, we're neighbors, we acknowledge them. Question is, are we going to be acknowledged in terms of the spaces we inhabit, the spaces we call home?
A referendum will answer that question this June. For Latino USA, I'm Sandhya Dirks in San Diego, California.
And now, mis queridos, a little philosophy about Latinos and where we belong in the vastness of the cosmos. A Mexican philosopher named José Vasconcelos believed a new race of people would one day be born out of the Americas. He called it la raza cósmica, the cosmic race. In 1925, Vasconcelos wrote that because Latin Americans are mestizos, a mix of European, African, Asian, and indigenous, that they as a people transcend all other races. Here's author Marie Arana speaking at the Library of Congress.
What Vasconcelos said at the time is that, in fact, Latin Americans are a cosmic race. Cosmic because of the blending for so many years. Cosmic also in a future sense because he believed that the experiment that was being conducted in Latin America of mixing races was an important venture. And he said, the leaders of American independence strove to free the slaves, declared the equality of all men by natural law, the social and civic equality of whites, blacks, and Indians. In an instant of historical crisis, they formulated the transcendental mission assigned to our region of the globe, the mission of fusing people ethnically and spiritually.
Vasconcelos believed that one day, la raza cósmica would erect a new civilization called Universopolis, where traditional ideas of race and nationality would be transcended in the name of humanity's common destiny. In fact, the National Council of La Raza takes its name from this idea. Here is then-Senator Barack Obama speaking to the council in 2008.
I'm told that the original phrase was La Raza Cosmica, the cosmic people. That's big. A term big enough to embrace the rich tapestry of cultures and colors and faiths that make up the Hispanic community. Big enough to embrace the notion that we are all part of a greater community, that we all have a stake in each other, that I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that we rise and fall together as one people.
That was, of course, before his administration deported 2 million people. But if you examine the demographics, the cosmic race seems to be emerging. And according to the U.S. Census, half of all Americans under the age of 5 are Black, Latino, or Asian. So it looks like la raza cósmica has indeed arrived. Coming up on Latino USA, how one engineer felt when she saw the first Latina astronaut.
It was in the auditorium when she first came up. And I was just sitting there going, I wish it was me.
It's Latinos and Outer Space next. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Tierra al comandante Tom.
Yes.
Control de tierra al comandante Tom.
Yes, estoy here.
Tome sus pastillas, póngase el yelmo.
Tómala, están.
control de tierra al comandante Tom.
Sí, ya oigo, ya oigo.
Comenzando cuenta atrás, motores en marcha.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition. We have liftoff of Discovery on the second mission to Planet Earth research flight.
That is the sound of the first Latina lifting off into space. Ellen Ochoa was 34 years old when she served her first space mission aboard the Shuttle Discovery in 1993.
I must say, it's a little bit hard to keep my concentration because I'm looking out the aft windows at some great views of South America right now.
Dr. Ochoa went on three more missions and even played her flute in space. Here she is talking to NPR host Michelle Martin in 2011, 2 years before becoming the first Hispanic and second female director of the Johnson Space Center in Houston.
My father's family is from Mexico, and it wasn't something I was thinking about, you know, being a first or anything when I applied. To me, it was just an exciting, wonderful career, a way to participate in exploration and discovery. But certainly, shortly after I was selected, I realized that there was a whole dimension to that that I hadn't thought about, and that was the opportunity to talk about exploration and science and engineering and education to a whole group. And there were so many Hispanic Americans who were excited about that. I started receiving letters immediately, and over the last 20 years, have received thousands and thousands of letters, lots from school children, about their interest in space after having read about me.
Jose Hernandez grew up working in the fields alongside his migrant farm worker parents. Then in 1972, he saw something that would change his life forever. Here's Hernandez on NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday in 2011.
I remember we used to have an old black and white console TV, and I would go outside, look at the moon, come back in, watch Gene Cernan walking on the moon, go back out, and I was just amazed that we had humans up on the moon 250,000 miles away.
A story of dedication, Hernandez applied to be an astronaut 12 times before finally getting chosen in 2009.
You go up and you taste it once and you want to go back. Day after I got back, I wanted to go back. I mean, it's almost addicting.
But he didn't get to go back. That same year, President Obama delivered a budget to Congress calling for the end of the shuttle program, and Hernandez decided to leave NASA.
When you train for a shuttle launch, 95% of the training is here at Johnson Space Center. So you come home every day. On the contrary, the International Space Station, it's more like a 2.5-year training flow. So I started doing the math, and I said, you know, I really want to enjoy my kids as they grow up.
And even though the shuttle program is suspended, astronauts continue to inspire us.
I'm Ellen Ochoa. I am a mission specialist and a flight engineer.
It's not just the astronauts who have paved the way for people of color. On the ground, Latinos have built equipment, they've programmed computers, and they've created the software to make sure that those shuttles actually take off. Candy Torres is one of those pioneers. Candy, welcome to Latino USA.
Well, I'm so excited to be here.
So you have this great nickname for yourself. You call yourself a
Techno-Rican. I mean, technology Puerto Rican or technology rich.
Candy, you talk a lot about a particular television show that you watched, no surprise, Star Trek. So how did Star Trek connect to you as a young Puerto Rican who dreamed of going into outer space?
Well, seeing people from different backgrounds, not even counting the aliens, but seeing all these different people working together. I mean, this is during the 60s, and I was very much aware of not just my own family, but what was going on in the civil rights era and all that. So it was stunning to me to see this diversity out there and exploring and really working towards a better future, that this is what we need to work towards.
And it really connected with you that Star Trek would actually be multicultural. It wasn't something that was just glossed over for you.
No. I was very much aware of everything, the sociological. I actually have a degree called Studies of the Future. I have a master's degree.
Okay, Candy, hold on a second. So you have a master's in the studies of the future, and you're an astrophysicist, and you also are a competitive fencer? I mean, what don't you do?
I'm also an artist. Museum of Fine Arts owns one of my murals.
Okay.
I want it to be Renaissance. Let me put it this way. Leonardo da Vinci was a very inspiring figure to me. When I was a child, I loved maps. And not seeing other role models, I did notice Torres Strait between Australia and New Guinea. And although I didn't expect that I was related to that person, I felt there's an explorer, there's someone with my name, had done something important, had explored. That was how I tried to find little things like that to connect with the culture.
Oh, I love this. When you were in Houston, you actually lived through what I can't imagine as an astrophysicist. When something like the Challenger explodes, what was that like for you?
I was there with a group of other people from JSC, and we were watching it. We'd watched many other launches. And we were stunned because we knew something was wrong because we'd seen so many and we knew the technology. And it was, we're part of family. The whole thing was, I did not have to stay there that day. I mean, I had nothing else to do, but I stayed on site the entire day. I went from the building where I was watching over to the building where my office was, which was where the flight controllers and the astronauts were. And I stayed there watching the news all day because that was family. I couldn't be anyplace else.
What is JSC?
Johnson Space Center. And that's where the astronauts come to train. And that's where we control International Space Station. And before that, the Space Shuttle program. So we're the human aspect of exploration.
Are there a lot of other Puerto Ricans who are working in space and inside NASA? I mean, do you guys have do you talk to each other?
Well, I did meet Joe Acaba when he first became an astronaut in 2004. I talked to him a couple of times because I wanted to be the first Puerto Rican astronaut. Of course, I was too short and too nearsighted to get very far. And I was also at JSC when Ellen Ochoa became astronaut. I was in the auditorium when she first came out. And I was just sitting there going, I wish it was me. I wish it was me.
We talk a lot about Latinas in STEM, particularly on Latino USA. And this notion that if you're Latino or Latina, it might actually be an asset for you in the fields of science, technology, engineering, or math. Do you feel that's true?
I think when you're studying, when you're first starting out, you really have to know what you want. And it's not necessarily other people that are going to keep you from doing what you want to do. It's yourself. And that's what I always focused on. What do I want and how am I going to get it? Because I didn't have role models. And that's the important thing, that we need role models, because it really, you need to feel connected. Now there are these opportunities, and I've been contacted by different people, for being a role model, which is what I wanted to do starting as a child. It was, I want to do all this for myself because it's exciting. And then I want to give back to the community because I don't want other people to struggle, both as my parents had and as I had to find my own way, that you can do it. And it's exciting. It's fun. It's being understanding the universe, being connected to the universe and being connected with other people and making the world a better place. I mean, you really do. It's just wonderful.
Candy, thank you so much for all the work that you do and for being the first Techno-Rican.
Thank you so much, Maria.
Candy Torres is an astrophysicist who's worked on projects for NASA, including the Space Shuttle and the International Space Station. Thanks again, Candy.
Muchas gracias.
Some people want to be astronauts, but become engineers instead. Other people who love space sometimes find a way to make it a part of their lives without having to make it their career. Like this guy.
Hi, my name is Peter Giacoumis, and I am a volunteer ambassador for Space Camp.
Peter grew up inspired by space.
The idea of man being able to reach out into the stars and use technology, being able to create the vessels, the science, the math, everything that goes into the aspect of launching a rocket and going beyond the bounds and restraints of our Earth and heading up to the moon or even beyond is just, to me, mind-blowing that we're able to do something like that.
Peter also grew up before the internet, when it was harder to find out about faraway opportunities. He didn't know that NASA ran a space camp for kids until one day when he came across some information about the program.
It was an advertiser, a print ad that I saw while I was in high school, and I thought that was one of the greatest things that anyone could possibly go to, really get a hands-on, see what this is all about. It just sounded so cool.
But by the time he found out about space camp, it was too late.
It was impossible. I had aged out. When I found out that this space camp existed, I was outside of the window for the age.
Cut to 30 years later.
Something hit me, one of those late nights where you're just, you know, on the net looking things up. And I said, well, you know, I wonder what ever happened to space camp. I found it and it existed. And I also found there was a family program. My son was just entered his teens. He was 13 years old. And I was like, this is for me.
He was living out one of his childhood dreams and getting to share it with his son.
When we actually got involved with the activities, I was happy to be able to explain things differently than if we were walking through, you know, the Museum of Natural History. It was an opportunity. We had never actually experienced something like that before.
Peter's son was more into video games and comic books than space, but the goal wasn't to change that.
There's something fun that you can get out of it. Not that you have to become that. You can, you know, study whatever, be successful in whatever you choose to do, but that you can always still pursue that, even on a level as a fan or a hobbyist or, you know, just because you enjoy that stuff. And so I was able to kind of show him that, you know, let him know that this is out there for you. To this day, he'll say how much he loved to go on a space camp with me.
When they got back, Peter found himself being a fan again, and not just of space.
All I kept thinking about was when I've been to a movie, I watch a television show that you become so enamored and impassioned with and that you pass that on. You go to your buddies, you go to your friends, you pick up the phone, you email and you say, listen, you got to see this movie. That was what I felt for my experience at space camp.
So he did a little research and found that NASA trains volunteer space camp ambassadors. So now, Peter visits schools and talks to groups about space camp. He says the cost of this exclusive camp often turns people off, but many families have no idea that scholarships are in fact out there.
Sometimes what you need is the human element, having a person show up and interact and maybe just give you the spark, that idea, give you the idea that it's there for you.
Peter's immigrant parents worked hard to give him opportunities, and now he wants to do the same thing for his son and others.
What more pleasure could I get than trying to positively influence the new generation? Hopefully, maybe somebody that I get to speak to pursues a career in science. You know, giving them an opportunity that I didn't have, for me, fulfills my destiny. I feel that that's part of what I should be doing is outreach and helping out.
For more information about Space Camp, go to latinousa.org.
Well, I'd like to visit the moon on a rocket ship high in the air. Yes, I'd like to visit the moon, but I don't think I'd like to live there.
And now, mis queridos listeners, we remember a journalist and learn from his words of wisdom or sabiduría. His name was Rubén Salazar, and he was one of the major chroniclers of the Chicano rights movement of Los Angeles. Born and raised in El Paso, Salazar occupied one of the most precarious spaces in American life, that of a journalist caught in the middle.
The Mexican American in this country has been sold a bill of goods for so long that it has weakened him to the point of impotence. From the beginning, he was sold the idea that he was white. In other words, one of the boys. Well, hell, he's not one of the boys. In my estimation, he's not even white.
Ernesto Vigil, a Chicano activist, knew the inequity that Salazar sought to expose.
With our hearts in our hands and our hands in the soil, we declare the independence of our mestizo nation.
this were Arabic, I'd say it's an intifada. It's a shaking off of this long-standing servitude.
During a demonstration that turned violent in August of 1970, Salazar tried to avoid confrontation by finding shelter inside a bar, but a sheriff's deputy fired a tear gas canister through the bar's doorway. Salazar was killed, a martyr of the Chicano rights movement at only 42 years old, and an American journalist killed on our ground. His writings describe a struggle Latinos are still experiencing today. Where do I fit in, and what is my space? In the 1960s, Rubén Salazar felt the answers were ambiguous at best.
Every society must have its ruling class. The U.S. ruling class is the white Protestant. Though counted as white by the census, Mexican Americans were never really thought of as such. Because I wasn't too dark, I was treated better than the darker Mexicans.
For more on Rubén Salazar, check your local PBS listings for the premiere of Rubén Salazar, Man in the Middle, a documentary about his life. It premieres on PBS stations this Tuesday, supported by our friends at Latino Public Broadcasting. And now, my dear listeners, we also want to remember some important musicians who we lost. The fabulous Cheo Feliciano was a hugely influential Puerto Rican salsa singer who passed away last week at the age of 78. And if you listen to this past week's Latino USA, you know that all of us here love salsa. But we also love the music of the Nueva Canción movement. So we say goodbye as well to Sonia Silvestre, the singer and cultural activist from the Dominican Republic, who was the voice of their new song movement. We'll leave you with a bit of her music today. She passed away last week at only 61. Adios, mi querida Sonia.
Teniendo belleza del sol y la flor, porque llora la tarde sabiendo que existe otro día.
And that's it for this week, queridos. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, and Camilo Vargas. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to the University of Illinois at Chicago's Latino Cultural Center for hosting our live chat with Lulu Martinez. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa, and join us again next week. And in the meantime, we'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on my Instagram. Hasta la próxima!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Latino USA's tech coverage is supported by the Caper Center for Social Impact, which leverages technology for positive, progressive change. Tech for good, good for tech. CaperCenter.org.
Funding for our series, Radio Nature, is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors.
Do you want some of this?
Support for NPR comes from Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring, with a floor finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.